Hello.
And welcome to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern, cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original, natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, practices, tools, resources, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode is leading functional health educator, Andrea Nakayama. As the host of the 15-Minute Matrix podcast and the founder of the Functional Nutrition Alliance, Andrea is leading thousands of students and practitioners around the globe in a revolution to offer better solutions to the growing chronic illness epidemic. By highlighting the importance of systems biology, root cause methodology, and therapeutic partnerships, she helps historically underserved individuals reclaim ownership of their health. Andrea was also one of the very first functional health experts I ever heard speak in the early days of the Health Summit. I've always been extremely impressed with her approach and her ability to communicate complex concepts and ideas in a very clear, simple way to understand for anyone. In this episode, you're going to learn what narrative medicine is, why it's essential for patient-centered care, and how it's transforming functional medicine. You'll learn why focusing on why instead of what can lead to more effective healing strategies. You'll learn the difference between healing and curing and why it matters in chronic illness recovery. And you'll learn how tuning into life events, traumas, and personal history can uncover critical healing insights that people might be missing. And a lot more. This is a super fun and paradigm-shifting conversation that might just change the way you view healing entirely, regardless of what your challenges and goals might be. In this episode, you'll notice we talk a bit about co-regulation, the nervous system, and ways to help your body feel safe. If these topics interest you, head over and grab my Breathing for Nervous System Regulation ebook at rebelhealth.co/breathing and start some simple practices today. And now let's get started with Andrea. Hey, Andrea, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to always talk to you, Michael.
Me too. These are fun conversations. It's like I was talking before we went on air that I didn't even write down any notes or questions for this one because we don't really have to. And we really kind of see eye to eye on a lot of things that we'd like to share in this episode that I think are important, like concepts and paradigms for patients to understand and for honestly, for practitioners to hear, because we're going to talk about some ways that even the functional medicine space is kind of lacking. And I don't know what I would, if I would call it bedside manner or just methods of interacting with patients and connecting with patients and understanding patients and helping them understand themselves. So a term that you use often, which I had never heard before the first time that I interviewed you, is narrative medicine. And I made up a story immediately in my head of what it means. I was like, that sounds cool. But what is narrative medicine? I don't even know. Is that, that's not a term you coined.
No.
That's a thing.
Yeah. It is a fairly young field. I feel like I should have some back it up stuff, but maybe we'll get into that. But, for me, the exploration into narrative medicine or finding my way to narrative medicine came from some of the gaps I was finding in functional medicine, which is, you know, what led me to that inquiry of where is the story? Where is the person? Where is the human in healthcare anymore? Mm. And how did we leave that behind? Conventional medicine has already done that. Why does that continue to happen? So narrative medicine is a fairly young and very academic and pedagogical field. It was born about 20 or so years ago in academic realm at Columbia University, where a doctor, Dr. Rita Sharon, and a literary professor started looking at this realm of active listening in patient care and what happens when we bring attention to the story and honor it as truth. Like, what is truth in medicine? And so it's a field that a lot of people, a lot of practitioners study, shouldn't say a lot, but it isn't a lot. It's a small field, but people studying that have recognized that there is a gap. And it is primarily a field geared towards providers who are learning to sit in that seat of active listening and learning and having conversations around it. I'm also trying to take those practices and put them in the pockets of the patient so that we too can actively listen to our bodies, to our histories, and understand that practice. So one other thing I just want to add is that the tool for practicing narrative medicine and active listening is engaging with the humanities. So we engage with the humanities, and by that I mean literature, poetry, film, music, dance, anything that is part of the arts or the humanities as a way to be reminded of humanity, right? Like we are talking to humans and we forgot that aspect of active listening, active sitting, active being with, and letting something wash over you. So it's a practice that in some ways feels disjointed from healthcare, but it exercises the muscle of tuning in, of actively listening, of exploring if I'm not in my left brain with the fix or the protocol or the answer, what actually happens that informs me so much more profoundly.
It's really fascinating to hear you talk about it from a context of like medicine. And because I don't know if you know, but I've been through training with Dr. Gabor Mate and his Compassionate Inquiry Program.
Yes.
And his method of inquiry that he teaches for therapists is quite similar to that in a lot of ways. And it's the connection felt by the client or the patient in that work, like the being seen, the being understood, the being validated, the co-regulation and like the feeling of the other there with you is the thing that does the stuff. Like it's the secret sauce. Like there's words and there's talking and there's things that are going on. But when you really get down to it, the essence of it is that. And that is, and this modality is primarily used for trauma healing and like addiction counseling and things like that. But it's just a human being there with another human in a
exactly.
connective level where it's not, you're not a bunch of numbers or you're not a bunch of lab tests. Because I mean, the functional medicine world, and I don't want to generalize, there's really good practitioners
yes.
too, but it's gone this like, here's this test, this test, this test, this test, this test. You've been diagnosed with these three conditions, and here's the diet and the supplements you need to do, and these therapies or treatments or whatever other kind of things, and in place of drugs or surgery, which is a plus. And then come back, you know, let me know in 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something how it's going, and good luck.
Yeah.
Not much about like how you got here or why you got here or what it's
exactly.
like to be there, which
yes.
I think is a big thing. I used to have patients or clients when I worked with clients, I'd have them cry when I would ask them questions like that all the
exactly.
time. They would just start crying.
Yes.
And I thought I was doing something wrong because I didn't understand any of this stuff then. And then now I realize they're crying because nobody had asked them those questions before.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right,
and
so what do you
not
see in patients that in clients, patients, like in those people, what do you see in people when they get asked their story and their questions and these kind of things for the first time? Like, how does that affect them?
Yeah. So I'm going to back up in two things because you said so much there, Michael, that I want to respond to. And there are principles that are used in various disciplines called a multi-narrative approach. And if we think about it in this regard, it really reflects a lot of what you were just sharing about where functional medicine has gone for a lot of people. So fact is something that has actually occurred. Perspective is a particular attitude. Narrative is fact plus perspective. And truth is when the narrative is believed. And when the narrative is believed, we are honoring an individual's truth And when a person's truth is validated and heard, there is an ability to step into the parasympathetic, the rest and digest, the place where healing can occur. If as practitioners, we are enforcing the cultural belief that everything is a fix, a find, a pill, a protocol, the perfect practitioner, we just need to find it. That is a sympathetic dominant fight or flight response that I worry that so many practitioners are advocating and enforcing that are keeping a population of chronically ill patients sick and not getting better. What I want to say about functional medicine is that I am 100% in service to the original foundations of a functional practice. And that has three primary tenets: a therapeutic partnership, which we're talking about right here and which you spoke about beautifully. Like, how do we actually see and honor the individual? I always like to remind patients there are two experts in the room. That person that you've been waiting 6 months to see is not the only expert in the room. You are the expert in you. And how do you show up with that information about you and your life in a way that can be received, but that you have to be in a space where that is invited to be received. So a therapeutic partnership. Number two is looking for the roots, which we say, why, not what? And I'm worried that a lot of the testing that we're doing today is not diagnostic. It's showing us more context versus diagnoses that we could have already known and saved that person a lot of dollars and worked in a broader realm instead of narrowing it down to what we believe are diagnoses and are actually not diagnoses. So people are walking around with a lot of beliefs about their body that are, again, enforced and encouraged by some of the testing that we're doing. And I'm not against the testing. I'm just questioning when we're doing the testing and why we're doing the testing. And I fear that it's often being used in a very conventional mode, that this is the diagnosis and then this is the treatment or protocol for that particular diagnosis. So number one, therapeutic partnership. Number two, looking for the roots, which means we ask why, not what. And number three is a systems-based approach. And for me, that honors the systems biology. Everything is connected in the body, the gut, the brain, the hormones, the detoxification, the gut, the immune system, you know, everything in the body is connected, but also finding systems, as I know, you know, I have, that help us to think through the complex. And we've gone into this very protocol way of thinking because it's simple. It seems simple. Do this for that. And functional medicine is designed for the needs of a person who has complex multifactorial issues, and it's adopting a practice, as are we as a culture, of a quick fix. And we need a framework that helps us think into complexities versus a protocol which is rigid and unfortunately leaves a lot of people sick and not getting better, but also incredibly frustrated with the money they've spent, the modalities they've pursued, without being seen and heard as an individual. So I just want to say that about functional medicine. Like, I am 100% in service to the founding principles of functional medicine. Where it has gone in my tenure in the field is mind-blowing. It has become a conventional medicine protocol-based approach. And I see it all over the place in books, on social media. Like, I have to opt out. And oh, what, yeah, the it books, led me
the
to
yeah. fix this problem exactly. with this protocol, and they sell like 10 million books. And because, and I think I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, I want to think that the whatever, we'll just use a random example. Say there's like a book on,
mold. Lyme.
And so the approach that they outline in the book really helped a patient of theirs. Once or themselves, like, or yes, themselves,
exactly.
like
exactly.
one or the other, either a patient of theirs or themselves.
Yes.
And then that's the thing that's going to help all the people with the same problem.
Yes.
And the more I learn, the more I learn that isn't true, that the same thing isn't it's not the same, like the same,
exactly.
it's not like the same diagnosis or the same subset of symptoms or the same lab tests on 20 different people, those 20 different people could have 20 different things driving that.
Exactly.
Right?
The diagnosis is a tipping point. The diagnosis is a tipping point. I have Hashimoto's. Anybody else, you and I can name 10 other people who have Hashimoto's that we know in common. We got there for different reasons and the expression is different. All we have in common is that our immune system has become overactive and started attacking tissues in our thyroid cells. That's all we have in common. Nothing else is the same. Are there some general principles that might be true for me and those 10 other people? Sure. But the pace we get there, how we actually embrace it, there's a lot. What you were saying is not only do we have to recognize that the person who wrote the book is well-intentioned and they've had success, but they've likely had success with a certain population, maybe a certain level of compliance, maybe a certain level of access to food and income that allows them to do certain things. And there's so many places of divergence that make it not an X for Y. And if we don't put that into the equation, we're missing the person. So just going back to the original question, two original questions that I'm holding that you asked me, what led me to narrative medicine in the functional nutrition matrix, which I've created and evolved from the Institute for Functional Medicine's matrix. I have three areas, which I call the story, the soup, and the skill. The soup is that systems biology. The skill is all the things we do, the sleep and relaxation, the stress and resilience. But the story is the piece that I realized was most missing. That is incredibly important because it has informed all and will inform the other parts of the matrix. And in functional medicine, that story is the antecedents, the triggers, and the mediators. And taking time to understand that with an individual really changes the course of healing. So to answer the second question you asked me, Michael, like, how does that impact the patient? When we understand and see and recognize their truth, not only are we, again, going into that parasympathetic, but we are starting to release oxytocin. We've got a jive going between us that is really beneficial for both of us, that opens things up to healing potential. I see my job as a clinician, and what I'm trying to teach other clinicians is their responsibility isn't to fix a diagnosis. It's to help an individual understand more of their mediators. And the mediators are part of our story. Our antecedents, our triggers, our mediators. You've done a lot of work into the triggers and understanding that trauma-informed care in a way that helps us recognize those. And I have to hold space for those. And ultimately, as a functional medicine nutritionist, I'm thinking, what makes you feel better? What makes you feel worse? The more of those you have in your back pocket, the better you have agency over your health. And the more I can help you understand those connections and actually own that, you are less reliant on me. Protocols are a very dependent, focused way of treating clients and patients. And what I'm talking about is a very empowered way of giving a patient back agency because you know these are my mediators. Again, what makes me feel better? What makes me feel worse? And then I have a risk-reward conversation that I'm in all the time with myself. This makes me feel worse when I X, but it's worth it in this moment because why I'm making that decision. I'm not bad or good. I'm not right or wrong. I have the agency to decide that. It's not that I'm defying my diet or my doctor. I'm empowered because I understand connections in my history, in my body, and in my actions.
Thank you for explaining all that. You have like, what is the opposite, whatever the opposite of ADHD is, you're able to remember those questions while talking about and laying out an entire framework of things.
I think I have functional ADHD.
Yeah. Well, that actually being able to hold multiple things at once is a superpower of ADD, but I don't think I could have kept it as clearly while explaining something else, but that was great. And just for terminology's sake, the mediators are things that make them feel better. Triggers
or
are
worse.
The root or worse.
Yeah.
Triggers are the things that got them there.
Triggers are the things that happen. Yeah. So antecedents, the ATMs, as they're called in functional medicine, are antecedents are everything we came into the world with or that we didn't happen to us directly. So it might be our genes, but we don't need to over anchor on those because epigenetics are huge, but they might be our genes, what our parents or grandparents had, our birth order, our birth methodology. The antecedents are like, what did I just get coming into the world? Like, okay. Did you live through a famine while you were in utero? What are those things?
And then the triggers are how they got there.
Yeah, the triggers are like what's happened in my life that I
they had a divorce. They had mold exposure.
Exactly. My husband died when he was diagnosed when I was pregnant. Like those are major triggers because they're going to impact my physiological function. The easy way I ask people to hold that is there a time where you had a before and after? Before I got that vaccine, I felt. Before I had that root canal, I felt. Before I moved to the Middle East,
it's shocking.
I felt.
People have, they know those things.
Totally.
Like if you ask them, they almost always know those things. It's not just like all of a sudden I felt really crappy all the time. There's always, I won't say always, but I try never to use that word. There's very, very frequently something, you know, one of the most impressive client kind of success on her, not on me, like I was just there, that I saw was this woman who was struggling with a whole bunch of different stuff. And this was before I had any training whatsoever in emotional work or trauma or nervous system or any of that. I was flying totally blind. I gave her this protocol that matched her stuff that was wrong with her, with supplements, diet, exercise, all this kind of stuff. I talked to her like a couple weeks later. We got on the phone. I said, how you doing? She just started crying. And I said, what's going on? And she said, well, I didn't do any of the things. And I said, okay. And at that time in my head, I was like, man, these people are so lazy. Don't they want to get better? Like I spent hours making this protocol for them and they're not doing it. Like what the hell? Like don't you want to get like you're staying sick on purpose? Like I start all these stories, you know? Plus I felt inadequate then because my client wasn't getting results. So I would internalize that and create all these stories. But I said, well, but instead of trying to say like, why didn't you do it or whatever? I just said, like, what's going on for you now? Like, how are you feeling now? Like, what's happening? And she said, well, I didn't do it because, I've been in a spiral because the day after our last session was the 2-year anniversary of when my son died. And I was like, oh shit. I don't know what to say to this. But I just winged it. Like, I was like, wow, that's really hard. Like, what was he sick? And she said, no, he had died in a car accident. And like, he had asked her for a ride or something. Like she was carrying guilt. Like she was carrying guilt that her son's death was her responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I said, did you told me in our first session that your health problems started about 2 years ago? And she's like, yeah, right after all that happened. But she didn't even think to tell me that.
Yes.
In the first session. And we spent that hour, that whole session where I was just listening to her talk about her son and like what had happened and like his favorite food, like all kinds of things. And I was sitting there in my head. I'm like, I'm wasting her time. I'm not helping her with her health things. Like I'm not doing my job. I'm just sitting here talking to this lady. I'm not even going to charge her for this. Like all the stories, you know, and then that was that. And then I was like, okay, well, we'll schedule another time to talk when you're more prepared to kind of do some of these things. She sent me an email like a few days later and said some of her pain was gone. She slept through the night. Like this other thing happened and she's ready to start XYZ things. So like, can I re-help her again, get started? And then she did the things, a lot of them. And within a few months, her whole situation, she lost a bunch of weight, she stopped binge eating, like, And I won't say it was all that conversation, but, and she started reading about like trauma and emotions. Yeah. 'Cause I did some legwork and research after I chatted with her and was like, yeah. I recommended a couple books about grief and about these things. And she did great. Like her total turnaround. I didn't even need to do very many more appointments with her.
Yep.
But she had seen other practitioners and been to the yep. doctor, and she didn't even think to mention to me that her son died and yes. that she got sick afterwards.
Yes.
Because nobody had asked this question.
Yeah.
And it was incredible to like witness it.
Yes.
And then she still, for a few years after that, would send me emails every once in a while just telling me how good she was doing and like, thank you so much. And it's ironic because the whole, like, the thank you was for a thing that during the thing, I was like, I'm not doing the right thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Beautiful work. And, you know, what a poignant story, Michael. And I think what it makes me really want to speak into is the difference between healing and curing. And I think a lot of people are stuck in a cure mentality. And there's been many brilliant people who speak about this, including Gabor Mate and Rachel Naomi Remen, who I love so much, Lissa Rankin, like so many people, so many doctors have spoken into this. But healing is a process that leads to a sense of wholeness and integrity. And curing is the act of eliminating a disease or correcting a problem. And those are two different things. And so that's one thing I just want to speak to, that we often confuse those two things. And we're looking for a cure, which will not happen without the healing. And you allowed space for the healing to drive the cure, as opposed to the other way around, which does not work. And that's the cycle of frustration that we're seeing people stuck in. In addition to that, I think it's important to recognize that there needs to be a process around which to hold that reality. And that's where, for me, the timeline process that we use in functional nutrition, or that I teach, I can't say all functional nutrition does it because it doesn't, really allows for the motivational interviewing. So we're not going from intake and the definition of the problem by the patient to the resolution. So the person that's stating the problem isn't the one, that's not the problem we're solving. We have to take the time to understand what it is. And it's not my job to cure. It's not my job to cure the weight loss or the pain. It's not my job to cure the trauma. This is a mistake I see so many of the practitioners I teach think, like, oh, because I recognize their trauma, I've just triggered it. And now what am I supposed to do about it? I am not a mental health practitioner, but holding space for that story and asking the right questions and helping to make connections is my job. Not saying I'm going to make that all better now, whether it's your SIBO or your the trauma you experienced as a child. But the way I'm holding the situation does lead to resolution. And that's where we get confused. It's not that I'm not actually resolving those things. I'm going about it in a less targeted way that actually allows for healing to occur. And we're in a healing to occur, and we're in a cure focused arena. So a good example of what you're talking about is finding those moments that were real triggers. And there's a couple of stories that I can share. One is when I was training my intake specialist who does the timeline on my team, and I had her do timelines with people I knew, so that I knew their history, but to see what she was filling out. And for my cousin, there was a big gap in one area of her timeline before she experienced symptoms. So a timeline is tracking your symptoms and your life history and looking at them in parallel to each other. So that gap is where the questions start to form. So before she had all her symptoms, what was going on in your life here helps me to see this wasn't on your intake, but there's something I'm missing. I know my cousin's youngest son was attacked by a pit bull and in the hospital for weeks on end before she experienced her hormone issues. She's coming looking for resolution to her hormone issues. He's fine. He's a senior in high school now. This is when he was a little kid. But I know that story. And so we have to know how to ask the right questions that helps us lead to connections. Another example, one of my favorite examples, is working with a woman in her 70s who would say, I've always had trouble sleeping. And my question can be, what does that mean? Take me back to the first time you remember noting it as trouble sleeping. Like, when was that? Tell me that story. She sent me like a picture of her childhood home, explained the windows, what was happening, what her fear was. There was nothing actually wrong that occurred, nothing nefarious, but she had a fight or flight response that was keeping her from relaxing because there weren't curtains on her window and it looked out over the neighbor's house. So she could never relax. And she remembers making sure she didn't fall asleep so that she didn't feel uncomfortable with what might happen or what she feared happening. So asking her the question, what do you mean you've always had trouble sleeping? Mm-hmm. Take me back. Tells me a story that leads me to a different clinical conversation and resolution than trying to fix it with passion flower or progesterone or melatonin. I'm not just fixing or curing her sleep. I'm recognizing the connections that led to a training of her body that now results in her 70s as something consistent. And she started to then make other connections. This is how I feel in the passenger seat of the car. All mm-hmm. of these things that gave her more insight. That's healing.
For sure. Thank you for sharing those. There's so much overlap between the questioning that Gabor teaches and that, like, because it's that we use the same line of questioning, like, when was the first time that you felt this thing? Like, if they come in and they're ranting about, like, they just got in a fight with their partner or, like, some sort of thing, it's like, well, stop, slow down. Where do you feel this? And what does it feel like? And can you describe what the sensation is when you're in this state of like outrage or whatever? And when was the first time that you recall, is this like a familiar feeling to you? And when's the first time you recall like this feeling or this sensation? And it usually goes back to like a fight with a sibling or something with a parent or something with a teacher or whatever. And then they're projecting the same story that they projected onto that as a child, onto this other person. And then you can kind of work with that. And that whole thing of, yeah, they didn't feel safe. She didn't feel safe with the open window. And I'm guessing she probably brought that up to someone and they didn't do anything about it.
Correct. And she would cry for her parents every night and they would come comfort her. Mm-hmm. But they were doing what we would think of as right, but
they weren't making her feel safe.
And they didn't give her shades for her. Yeah. Like they never and like identified that's that, the
like
problem.
A child to not be, we're going off track here, but a child to not receive the protection from their people who are supposed to protect them teaches them forever that until there's an intervention, it teaches them forever that there is no protection, that there's no safety, that they're not worth it, or like there's no, you know, like that kind of story. So it's really fascinating. And I think that I think there needs to be more crossover here. I think that more health practitioners need to be trained in this kind of like work and questioning, because from the therapist side, they're looking to help people with anxiety or depression or these kind of things. They're not trying to help them with like their GI issues or their migraines or their insomnia or something like that. But the questions that need to be asked to help people get to have that connection and be seen and like build the awareness, like the key for that was that woman then understood herself.
Yes.
Like, and it was witnessed.
Yes.
Both.
Exactly.
And like that awareness, and you mentioned it at the very beginning, you said something, relationship, put the practices in the pocket of the patient, of like building awareness about themselves, like self-awareness and noticing like, oh, when I go into work in the morning, my belly gets upset.
Exactly.
And like 20 minutes later, I'm in the toilet.
Yes.
But on Saturday, that doesn't happen. Or like the people who say, my symptoms go away when I'm on vacation.
Right.
Like how common is that? Like, oh, I went to the beach and I didn't have this XYZ thing for a week. And it's maybe I need to live on the beach. It's like, maybe you get to take a look at what's in your life.
Yes, exactly. And those are our mediators. That's where we understand. Like, so an example for myself is drinking coffee. I love coffee with my coconut milk and some raw honey. I love it. If I drink coffee during the week and my job is busy, I have a team and there's goals and there's a lot to do with the school that I run. And because it sits on a larger platform now of other programs, there's a lot to do. And if I drink coffee on work days, I feel fine in my body, but I notice I'm a little bit more aggressive and I'm already a really driven, really pointed, really direct person in how I run my team, right? And the business. And so it doesn't serve me because it's not serving others. If I wake up on a Saturday and I'm going to do a little writing and go work out and see my boyfriend that day, there's no issue with that coffee, but my awareness of not just how does that make my body feel, but how does that make me feel because of how I'm received in the world? If I'm more inflammatory in any way, like how is that received, helps me make a decision. And again, risk reward. There are some days I am having that cup of coffee because
and there's
really
nothing
want
morally
it.
Wrong about it. Exactly. I like the way that you kind of hammered that earlier, like you have agency, you're making a decision, like you're making a decision, like I know that if I do this, there's a chance this is gonna be like this. If I don't do this, it probably won't be like that.
Yes,
I'm choosing to do it today. That's a conscious choice. And then enjoy it while you're doing
exactly. Exactly. And like just that, that's a minor place of being tuned in. But I think the point I want to make here is we've lost our own truth. So if I go over that multi-narrative approach, fact, perspective, narrative, truth, we've lost touch with our own truth in favor of looking for some fact about ourselves, often some other person's perspective. And when we tune in, these little things add up to helping us to say like, oh, I am in my optimal self-care. It's not just about the choices I make around diet and exercise. Like there are other things that actually give me joy and pleasure, which are as much a part of my nutrition as eating my kale or getting my blueberries or pomegranates or whatever we want to talk about. Like it is broader than we are giving credence to. And the real messages have to come in part from that therapeutic partnership and recognizing our role in that partnership. And I don't say that as a to-do for folks who are already doing so much. I say it as a potential reframe. Maybe you're focused on the wrong to-dos, or maybe I don't even want to say right or wrong. Maybe you're focused on the to-dos that are not supportive of how you show up in your therapeutic partnerships and how you show up for yourself that could go a long way, like with the case you shared, where her recognition enabled her to make decisions and choices for herself that took her to her health goals with your guidance, as opposed to with your godlike protocol or, you know, pills or whatever it was.
Well, that's what I wanted it to be. But yeah, it was an accident. I can't take credit for doing it intentionally, but it was a huge lesson though. At the time, it made me not want to work with clients because I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. Now I look at it and it was probably like the most skilled interaction I had with a client, but I didn't know that then. So then
exactly.
all about perspective and like story that you have. But this is, yeah, I've scribbled a bunch of notes. I love that you are able to systemize and kind of talk about something that is inherently, I would call right-brained, but you're doing it in like a left-brain kind of way. Like you give it names and systems and ways, but to teach it to others, to implement it, it almost has to be that way. Like there has to be, teaching something without that is possible. It's just very difficult. Like it has to be, you almost need, what is that called? That we don't do anymore. Apprenticeships.
Right.
To teach in a way that is, not, structured and systemized and all of that. And I struggle with that. I struggle to put the right brain things into like left brain context or definitions or categories, or I don't know the right word, structure systems. And I enjoy that hearing them, and then they make sense. And it's, and you have this, I don't know what to call it, foundational kind of structure in the practitioner training that you've created, right?
Yeah, it's definitely, this is a mantra that's working throughout, even though the 10-month program is focused around systems biology.
Yeah.
It's the thinking of where food meets physiology through not just food. I'm going to say food is even sleep, joy, poop, all the things that help us understand the body. But I think one of the things, and I always appreciate, Michael, that reflection that you have, because it isn't as sexy to think in frameworks as it is to think in protocols. You know, I have a book deal. It's hard to get to the book because people want protocols.
Yeah.
Agents want protocols. Publishers want protocols. And it's, I know that there's a reframe that needs to happen. It's just not as sexy because we're so geared towards wanting the thing we think is going to cure and give us answers. But I just want to say to that reflection that I always appreciate that you have for the work I do and the frameworks and the systems is that my biggest teachers were my students who didn't get it. So instead of blaming them for not getting it, it made me have to step back and step back and
figure out new ways to teach it to them.
Exactly. And how do I simplify this to get this point across? And I want to say for any practitioner, your patients that are your most difficult patients are your best teachers to question and make sure all your biases are in check. And even with our relationships with ourselves, when we're trying to impose something, what are our bodies trying to tell us when we are imposing some strict set of rules on it that we're not hearing because we're being dogmatic or biased about what's supposed to work? So my students, and I've been so fortunate to have over 8,000 graduates in over 68 countries because they teach me. When I come out of the classroom and I'm frustrated, there's a lesson in there for me because I'm like, what did I not say? How can I say it better? How can I deliver this point? And it's, you know, one of the things that I hope sets me apart as an educator in a field that's very saturated and is offering a lot of protocol thinking.
It is. And that's a great insight as to how this kind of came about is, you know, plus you're teaching to a bunch of different learning styles, and it is the ones who don't get it. It's not that they're not capable of getting it. It's that you didn't put it in front of them in the right way.
Exactly.
And figuring out how to put it out there in the way that the most people get it is probably, you know, or the thing that gets refined over time as well. And there's always going to be someone who then doesn't get that. And so you get to tweak it a little bit more and exactly. Make it a little more clear, or make it in overlapping ways to teach it, you know, a visual way, a written out way,
exactly. You
know, thing like that. I used to teach, I don't think a lot of people know that I was a teacher for a little bit out of college. I taught high school and it was difficult. I taught U.S. government, which is a required class in Illinois, at least. And that means you have to pass it to graduate. So, but it was a mix of seniors who had taken it like two or three times and really didn't want to be there and were kind of like, and like overachieving straight A student freshmen who were getting it out of the way at the beginning. And they were like eager, sitting on the edge of their chairs, like staring at me while some other kid's like trying to smoke a cigarette out the window and doesn't care at all. And I have to like engage both of them.
Yes.
And that's not easy to do. And I think the more clear ways to give systems and these kind of frameworks hits the different levels of students and the different ways of learning. So I love the way that you put things together. And I even scribbled some notes on like how I could twist some of this into doing the other kind of work also that's not related to like physical symptoms, but more the other side of things and ways that I don't see it. And so, and you, the last thing is you mentioned in the connection with the practitioner, when they feel seen, they get oxytocin, and that's like a amplifier of opening and healing. I actually worked on a presentation today. They also get increased heart rate variability, you know, parasympathetic nervous system activation kicks in. Yes. Their nervous system kind of regulates. They have a greater window of tolerance as to like what they're going to be able to handle. And they walk out of there feeling safer because someone has their back. And like the cascade that starts is can be really remarkable, especially for the people who have done the protocols in the labs and they have these diagnoses and I have this disease and this thing wrong with me and whatever, and they've never had that experience. So kudos to you and this way of working, I think, is essential, especially as people are getting like sicker and more complex and these chronic illnesses and they come in with 16 diagnoses and they've been to 9 practitioners and nobody's asked them these questions. Nobody's asked them about their life or their timeline or their any of it. And they haven't put those pieces together either.
Right.
So, I mean, we could talk forever. I know we got to go, but where can people find you, your work, whether they're a practitioner, whether they're somebody who wants to learn?
Yeah, I'm going to send folks over to AndreaNakayama.com or Andrea Nakayama on all the places, Instagram. That'll lead you back to the Functional Nutrition Alliance. But the work I'm doing on my personal platform is more narrative medicine based. I've written about what is narrative medicine. I've written about the issues with biohacking. I've written about a lot of the things that we are speaking about. I have an article I'm about to publish around protocols versus frameworks. So all of that work is there, and I do free narrative medicine workshops quarterly. So people are open to show up with that for that. If they're on my newsletter, they will learn about those. And then that'll also lead you back, that site, to all the work at the Functional Nutrition Alliance, where I am training practitioners in this methodology. And to your point, Michael, like we have doctors in the program. All the nurses I train say, like, this is what I thought I was going to get in nursing school. I didn't. Dietitians, health coaches, but we also have people who made changes in their lives and want to help others in what they learned for themselves or be able to take that and go forward. And it is my greatest joy that I don't dictate what they're doing or what scope they work in or who their niche is, but that I'm giving all those different types of people who want to help others the tools and the frameworks to go do so successfully. And how we will all do it is different, but the tools and the frameworks are the same. And what a relief that is to know when we can sit in a framework that supports what we're trying to do, no matter what that is.
It's beautiful. And everybody go check out both places. I need to come to one of your narrative medicine workshops, probably.
I'd love that.
I think that'd be really fun. And, it gives me a much warmer feeling towards the future of what functional medicine could be, thinking that like this is possible to weave this in, because it's radically, like, drastically missing in a lot of those places. So thank you so much for the time, the conversation. I think we did pretty good with no notes or scripted questions.
Always.
And I look forward to the next time we could connect.
Same, Michael. Thank you.